This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. Things in Hong Kong this week escalated horribly. As we recorded this episode, a siege was still underway at the Polytechnic University in Kowloon, and police warned they would fire live ammunition if the protesters didn't stop attacking them. Also this week, Chinese troops appeared in the city as Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, called for a peaceful resolution to the latest standoff.
The first is, of course, to have a peaceful resolution as far as possible. This objective could only be achieved with the full cooperation of the protesters.
All this against a backdrop of major breaking news about China, the way it's persecuting the Uyghur minorities in Xinjiang, and also how it operates in the Pacific. On this week's episode of Please Explain, we'll take you to Hong Kong, where our China correspondent Kirsty Needham is witnessing the chaos firsthand. And later on in the show, I'll be talking to international and politics editor Peter Harcher and chief political correspondent David Crowe about China's influence in Hong Kong and Australia.
We're at Polytechnic University in Hong Kong, where riot police and special forces have just stormed in. There were snipers firing tear gas and potentially rubber bullets down from the opposite building. Protesters were caught by surprise. They rushed inside the building. There were Molotov cocktails being thrown, and there were fires lit everywhere. The Special Forces Police have now withdrawn, dragging some protesters with them, but there's a new problem, and that's the huge amount of flammable material that had been stockpiled by protesters, and we see fires now breaking out at pedestrian footbridges and inside the campus.
Kirsty Needham, thanks for joining Please Explain from Hong Kong yet again. It feels like you have spent the better part of the last 4 months there now.
It certainly does feel like that to me, yes.
Every time you go there, it escalates. You know, it all started out as these 2 million Hong Kongers with babies in prams and grandparents marching in the streets full of hope. This week, it has become particularly distressing. You were inside the Polytechnic on Sunday night when it all started to go horribly wrong. Can you tell us about that, please?
That's right. On Sunday afternoon, the police, after being absent for 2 or 3 days, as thousands of university students and other protesters had been inside that university, barricading themselves in physically with chairs and any bits of metal, physically building brick walls to stop what they thought would be a police charge into their building. But most disturbingly, they were building bombs. The police had described the campus as a weapons factory, and to be honest, walking through there, there was a lot of Molotov cocktail making going on, groups of students sitting around, and just a production line making a dozen beer bottles in a tray, sealing them off and then sending them out to the perimeter of the campus. So then on Sunday afternoon, the police tried to take the campus from three sides. As it grew later in the evening and the police front lines drew in, a cordon was placed around the whole area and police said anyone coming out would be arrested. And that certainly happened as medics, online journalists even, and support workers had tried to leave, particularly because the police had announced on Facebook that they were prepared to use live bullets and live rounds against the students if they didn't stop firing rocks down from catapults onto the police water cannon and throwing Molotov cocktails. And clashes between the protester and police front lines continued, neither side gaining ground until the very early hours of Monday morning, when suddenly riot police rushed in from a side street. There were snipers on the Science Museum building opposite the campus. We were holed up on a balcony, a very sturdy granite balcony, probably about 50 metres away. We had clear sight of the police lines of police coming in. And to be honest, when we heard those loud cracks from the rifles, we didn't know whether it was live rounds. So everyone ducked. Even the cameramen abandoned their cameras on the balcony and just ducked for cover until we could establish that it was rubber bullets and sponge rounds and huge volumes of tear gas that were being fired. Now, because of the number of Molotov cocktails that were stockpiled around the campus, huge fires were set off. The entrance to the university became a fireball. Some of those Molotov cocktails ignited the huge amount of material that had been stockpiled inside by the students. They ran inside. The police quickly withdrew from the entrance in the face of that fire, but there was hundreds of protesters on barricades outside the campus, and they were dragged away by the police off the streets. An eerie calm descended at dawn as the sun came up. Eventually, fire crews were allowed in to try and stop some of these fires. But that, I guess, was the start of a siege in earnest. And from all throughout Monday, we saw groups of students trying to escape. They had been told they would face 10 years in jail on rioting charges if they came out. It's sort of a funny way to try and get thousands of students out of a building. We saw people climbing off highway flyovers down ropes as motorcyclists came in to try and speed them away. Last night, there was another breakout attempt, students running down the road, but they were quickly caught by police. There's a ring of steel around that university now. Yesterday, Carrie Lam said that she offered a more humanitarian approach, that a deal had been struck between the police and about 30 school principals who said that they wanted to go in and try and persuade the children to come out. 300 minors, these are school kids coming out.
Kirsty, we should clarify for our listeners that you and I are discussing this on Wednesday morning in Hong Kong, and by the time this podcast actually comes out and people listen, this siege may well be over or it may have escalated. We just don't know. Can I ask you about the sort of extreme nature of the students' actions? That all those bombs that you're talking about them making, they have really stepped it up a notch. Has this happened organically, or has there been some instruction from somewhere or encouragement from someone in particular to really take it up to this much more dangerous level?
This is organic, and it's in response to what they see as police brutality. These protests have continued to 5, now 6 months, because one of the demands of the protest movement, which is very widespread throughout the Hong Kong community, is they want an independent inquiry into police violence. Some people are seeing it daily on their TV, that when police make arrests, they bludgeon and hit. There have been horrific injuries as arrested protesters are later taken to the hospitals, and the hospital staff have been out striking and protesting at the injuries they're seeing. So this is what has led to the bomb making, and it is organic. These students are leaderless. They share information online and through social media, so they're sharing bomb recipes. And what we saw last week, Chinese university students were the first ones to start this bomb making, and then it spread to the other campuses. So it is organic. There's no one leading this. And unfortunately, it's happening in a political vacuum where there isn't a leader who can come in and negotiate to resolve this politically.
So earlier in the week, also members of the PLA from the mainland showed up as a sort of cleanup crew wearing these strange, relaxed civvy uniforms. Was that a sign, do you think, that Beijing is potentially going to send in forces to deal with this escalation?
Yeah, it was absolutely a deliberate signal. So on Sunday afternoon, the PLA, maybe it's their definition of civvies, but they were wearing matching military khaki T-shirts and black shorts, and they marched in formation out of their barracks in front of Chinese state media cameras. It was very clearly a propaganda event to dismantle barricades. It sent shockwaves through Hong Kong on social media as it happened, because they have very rarely come out of their barracks, and people believe this is a signal of what potentially could happen. Could it be a softening up to get Hong Kong people prepared for the presence of troops on the streets? But Carrie Lam was asked about this on Tuesday at a press conference, and she said, "We have confidence in our own ability, the Hong Kong government and police, to handle this ourselves." But she said, "This is why we need to resolve the polytechnic siege ourselves." Sort of that question hanging there, that if they can't, there's a very pressing likelihood that the PLA will be sent in, or they may need to request the PLA to help.
What's the mood like in the rest of Hong Kong?
It's a very dark mood. People are, you know, quite despairing at what has happened. For a week now, major transport links have been disrupted. There's one Cross Harbour Tunnel that has been shut for a week because the toll booths have been bombed. This is right next to the Polytechnic University, and that highway disabled. School has only gone back this morning after a week. The school students, the education department said that on Wednesday morning schools can go back, but as these kids caught the train to a lot of these schools, they were lined up against the wall by riot police and surge, because there's such a rift, mistrust between the police force and the school students. That's the way police and kids interact these days. That's a really worrying sign for this society.
How do the Hong Kongers feel about the students who are engaged in the most extreme action?
Well, when you speak to Hong Kongers, and this might be surprising, they support them. So consistently, I've spent lots of time asking people, what do you think about the violence? And online polling actually shows, it's conducted by universities and newspapers here, that they blame the police for the violence. And their feeling is that the students are brave enough to carry on these protests and escalate the violence, that the older generation are not brave enough, but they support the actions of the young. And that's quite a shocking state that a community has come to that point. Often on the back lines of protests, you will see parents, you'll see the elderly, you'll see a really wide cross-section supplying and providing support.
Kirsty, it's very hard to watch even from this far away. It must be very hard to watch up close.
It's really hard when you see how out of control the situation is, how young some of the people involved in this are, how emotional and angry and off the leash the police are, and how ineffective the government and the politicians here are. I wouldn't say all of the politicians, even on the pro-Beijing side, there are some quite sensible voices offering suggestions of how this could be resolved. But Carrie Lam seems unwilling or unable to show leadership and offer any resolution.
Well, Kirsty, next week you will be back in Sydney because you will be attending the Walkley Awards, where you have been nominated for an award. So good luck with that, and we look forward to seeing you.
Great. Thanks, Tori.
That was Kirsty Needham, China correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Very soon, I'll be joined by Peter Hartcher, who is the politics and international editor, and David Crowe, our chief political correspondent.
Hi, I'm Lisa Davies, editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. The Herald and Age newsrooms are home to some of the country's most experienced journalists, delivering trusted news and analysis every day. But we can't do it without you. Our subscribers get unlimited access to our award-winning independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Subscribe today and support news you can trust.
From the team that brought you Phoebe's Fall and Wrong Skin comes a new 10-part investigative podcast.
Motor Vessel Pong Su, I intend to board you.
I thought to myself, this is this f***ing boat.
The Last Voyage of the Pong Su is a story of drugs, cops, espionage, military, death, a dictator, and mateship.
Flag of my honor is Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
150 kilos of heroin had never been imported before.
These people, they expected to be executed.
It's a dead person.
Holy shit.
Search for The Last Voyage of the Pong Su on your favourite podcast app.
Peter Hutcher, David Crowe, welcome back to Please Explain.
Thanks for having me, Corey.
I'll start with you first, Peter. On Monday, former Prime Minister Paul Keating accused the Australian media, and specifically us, of pious belching over our coverage of China's influence here in Australia. How do you respond to that?
Well, I thought it was pretty funny, actually. And I don't disagree with everything Keating said in the speech, but I found it pretty difficult to cop the notion that he said in the speech that explicitly he named the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age two anti-China stories in that day's paper. That was Monday's paper. Now, anti-China story, that's a pretty interesting label. The stories that he was referring to were, one, our summary of the New York Times leak of 400 pages of internal Chinese Communist Party documents about the systematic repression and cultural genocide of the Uyghur minority in China.
And that story also included condemnation by the Australian Foreign Minister of that behaviour.
That's right. It included Maurice Payne's reaction to the revelation, the irrefutable evidence that from the very top of the Chinese system, the president himself, Xi Jinping, led this movement for the mass incarceration of the Uyghur people of northern China purely for the crime of being Uyghurs. So that was one story that Keating called anti-China. The other story was the story by our Ben Bohane, our report that morning. He's in Bougainville, which is about to have an independence referendum, and he reported that Bougainvillean politicians were being offered bribes of $200,000 each by Chinese figures if they would agree that a newly independent Bougainville switch its diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to mainland China. Now, these are the two stories that Keating calls anti-China. So he's implying there what? That we are somehow unfair and unbiased to report the facts? Is he implying that we shouldn't have run those stories? So that was pretty interesting labelling. He clearly thinks that the Australian public should be denied key information about the nature of our biggest economic partner because it doesn't fit with his own personal position. The final thing I'd say about that is that nowhere was there in his speech, in print or in the broadcast, the disclosure that he sits on the board of one of the major Chinese state-owned banks.
David?
I thought it was a fascinating speech. I enjoyed watching it. I thought it was had some many really interesting points to make about Australia and China, and especially the fact that all superpowers can be nasty, right? You know, I thought there were some interesting points to be made there. But I found it fascinating that he didn't mention Uyghurs at all. He criticised that story, but talked about China without mentioning Hong Kong or the Uyghurs. And these are big issues that Australia is grappling with at the moment, as we can see with the way the government has to deal with China on human rights issues as well as trade. So to not mention them, I think, was a fairly glaring absence from the speech. And when he talked about Tiananmen Square three decades ago, he referred to the Tiananmen demonstration. Other people used much stronger language than that to describe what happened in Tiananmen Square in 1989. And so I think his language and his omissions were quite revealing, actually.
The coverage of our relationship with China and the attempts of China to exert influence here and in the Solomons and of human rights abuses is certainly becoming more alarming. Do you think there's any risk of it becoming alarmist?
Yes, I think there is a risk of it becoming alarmist, and that's why I thought some of the points that he was making, that Keating was making in that speech, should be made. Australia does have to be careful because it's dealing with a global superpower, and therefore there is a need for nuance in the debate. And sometimes at times like this, nuance is the hardest thing to come by if you're having a complex debate about a country such as China. And I think it's been really interesting that people are starting to distinguish between talking about China and talking about the Chinese Communist Party. Two different things. You know, you're not making a sweeping generalisation about an entire nation and its civilization. You're talking about the nature of its totalitarian state and the fact that you are dealing with a government that is a single party, very opaque, where we can't always be really sure about where it's going and what it's on about. So I think there is always a risk of things going over the top in the China debate, yes.
Peter, two people who are accused of perhaps lacking some nuance in their public statements are Andrew Hastie and James Patterson, who another very interesting China story that broke on Friday night was that they were due to go on a study tour to China with an organisation called China Matters, and their visas were refused. Should they have been surprised that that happened, given the outspokenness of them about China's human rights abuses?
Probably, because the Chinese government is showing a new fragility, a new sensitivity about any criticism of it and its performance, its record. So that is an increased level of sensitivity from the Chinese. So it is a bit surprising. It's also an indicator of a couple of things. One, that the Chinese system has a great deal of trouble dealing with any kind of dissent, even if it's spoken in a foreign country by a couple of backbenchers. And the other point I'd make is that the Chinese economy is the size of all of the European Union plus Japan put together. That's how big it is. It grows the equivalent of a new Australian economy every 2 years, even at its current subdued growth rate. And this mighty power, what? It's afraid of a couple of Australian backbenchers criticising their human rights practices. Why are they so frightened?
The reason it surprised me is that so far the Communist Party has demonstrated a sort of long-sighted view on influence. Any influence that's been proven to have been attempted here in Australia has been a long game. I would have thought that these two relatively young politicians who are inevitably at some point going to end up in the cabinet of a future coalition government, that the Chinese authorities might have thought, well, let's try and get them over here and at least talk to them.
That's been their traditional approach. I think this just tells us that the Chinese have decided to step up their conditioning and attempts to discipline foreign critics, even foreign legislators. So that speaks to the level both of the paranoia, but also the ambition of the Chinese state. And the second thing is, many people have made that point, Tori, including Australian politicians and ministers, that it would have been better for China's own interests had it allowed them. Well, I think it's pretty interesting how far Australians are prepared to go to make that concession to help the Chinese, advise the Chinese government on how to handle foreign critics. It's very broad-minded of us.
David, how worried is the Australian government about the current situation in Hong Kong?
Very worried. The statements from Maurice Payne as foreign minister have become, I guess, increasingly concerned about what's happening there. You notice this constant message that what's happening in Hong Kong should be resolved within Hong Kong. That is, do not send troops across the border. Now, of course, we have seen troops from the PLA in Hong Kong cleaning up, you know, so there is an exercise there that gets everybody accustomed to the fact that the PLA troops are on the street. And so these things are leading to greater concern within the Australian government, but also in the opposition. Penny Wong, as the Foreign Affairs spokeswoman, has also made increasingly concerned statements about what's happening there. And I really noticed them this week because of what was happening at the Polytechnic University in Hong Kong. And it was very interesting to see the fears really ratcheting up in Australia.
There's approximately 100,000 Australian citizens living in Hong Kong. The Australian government is generally reticent to sort of say, oh, we'll come and rescue our citizens. They prefer to just advise people to make their own decisions and get out before things turn really nasty. Is there any sense that if things really do escalate, that DFAT will attempt to help Australian citizens in Hong Kong in a more extreme way than just normal consular assistance?
To step it up would be a major, major move. And that's been one of my questions this week. Is it going to be stepped up to the next notch, which is basically do not go there? And I was told, look, that would be a fairly significant step, and that's not on the plan at the moment. It all depends on events, and they changed by the day. But it is interesting, there's 100,000 Australians there, so many expats working there, but we haven't seen a widespread discussion about, do we need to get them out? It's such a huge number of people. How could we? I mean, how can you deal with that? There are two worlds. There's the world on the street, and then there's the expat world in the office towers.
Peter, you have written a quarterly essay called Red Flag, which comes out next week and is being extracted in this Saturday's Good Weekend. What is that about?
Started with the concept that Australia needed to wake up to the influence operation that China was waging against Australia. But as the weeks went by, I think Australia's already started to wake up to that. And I thought it was time to go to the next phase, which is we now realise we have this tremendous dilemma. We have a deep economic relationship with a country that is fundamentally opposed to all values that we hold dear and will crush them at every opportunity, whether it's the Uyghurs, whether it's trying to take control of the judicial system in Hong Kong, whether it's trying to discipline Australian politicians from criticising it, or the essay also runs through 11 cases in the last 10 years of Chinese economic coercion, punishing other countries using China's economic power, and the fact that we are going to face a lot of that. We are all going to face more of that as China gets bigger and more assertive. What do we do about this? One point where I did agree with the Keating speech is that Australia hasn't reconciled these two. On the one hand, we've got an economic and foreign affairs, if you like, coalition in the Canberra bureaucracy advising that Australia should always appease the Chinese. Whatever they do, we should just cop it. And on the other hand, we've got the security agencies who are very hawkish and saying, oh, whatever we do, we have to crack down on the Chinese. The federal government has not yet reconciled these two conflicting impulses. I think Keating's right about that. My essay was an attempt to say there is a path forward and to set out an agenda for things that we can do, and just to put it in a very brief nutshell, one sentence, to toughen our internal protections, protect our democracy, our political system, and our economy and our society better, so that having, metaphorically, if you don't mind the phrase, armour-plated ourselves and our systems against Chinese intrusion, then we can much more confidently and robustly deal with China and engage China on the important stuff where we do need to work with China.
David, do you think that the Morrison government leadership is equipped to walk that incredibly delicate balance?
That's a big question, because I think in many ways the government's still a work in progress on that front and on other policies that they're dealing with. And so we judge them as things develop. We have seen a very big speech from Scott Morrison about China and trade, where he said, look, China's no longer a developing nation, they're a developed economy, and they should be treated that way in global trade talks. So that was perceived as being anti-China. I think there was an aspect of it which was being realist about the rise of China and the fact that it doesn't get treatment or shouldn't get treatment as a developing nation anymore. But I think they're also, you know, loath to pick a fight where none is, in their view, needed. They approved a foreign investment purchase in the last week for a Tasmanian dairy company that produces infant formula. This is a huge business with a lot of demand from China. And there are questions about, you know, how that company is worked with the Chinese over the last year or two. They were locked out of the Chinese market. Now they're being bought by a Chinese company. The government has approved that purchase of Bellamy's, and I noticed that the head of the Foreign Investment Review Board, David Irvine, former head of ASIO and ASIS, said, look, it wasn't a strategic asset, and therefore he couldn't see any reason to block it. He was talking in those terms this week. To me, that highlighted the problem of dealing with China Inc. China Inc. is a government that bans a company from exporting its product to mainland China, crashes the share price, and then later a Chinese company comes along and buys that Australian business. Where does the government stop and private enterprise begin in that world of China Inc.? That's something that the government is still actually wrestling with, but it's not the only government that's wrestled with it. We saw that under Turnbull. We saw that under Tony Abbott. We saw that when Kevin Rudd and Wayne Swan brought in different rules for state-owned enterprises, because China's a moving target in many ways on this front, and we're always playing catch-up with this changing world.
Thanks, David and Peter.
Thanks, Tori.
Pleasure, Tori.
Thanks to our Please Explain guests this week, Kirsty Needham, David Crowe and Peter Harcher. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms, so to support independent journalism, search Subscribe, Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. If you're listening to this in Brisbane or Perth, why don't you consider subscribing to WA Today or The Brisbane Times? This episode of Please Explain was produced and edited by Leah Simoglu and Nicole Priestel. Technical assistance from David McMillan. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating or review on iTunes. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.